and his lecture is about the geometry of music.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to try the experiment of actually speaking only for half an hour. Which means I'm not going to say everything. It's usually kind of it's a bit of a squeeze to get this talk into an hour. So I'm going to give you more of a bird's eye view of what I've been doing. The basic idea or the interesting point for you guys of today's lecture is that I'm going to be talking about a principled way of translating musical information into geometrical or spatial information and also vice versa. And so what this opens the door to is not only visualizing music, so we can take pieces of music and watch how they traverse interesting geometrical spaces, but you could actually also go the other way and build physical objects that give new ways to interface with the musical realm. So this could cover toys or educational devices that teach people about musical relationships. You could have dancers moving through physical space, having their motions translated into musical information. You could build sculptures that were pictures of the space of three note chords or three note quartzites and have musical interaction that was driven by something more than metaphor, where the space is actually telling you something interesting about the musical relationships. You could have video games where you are traversing certain kinds of topological worlds, and the music that you're hearing is related to where you are in space. My interest in coming to this talk was just to sort of maybe get some people thinking along these lines. I know some of you are sculptors, or all of you are artistic in some way. There is the possibility for, I think, a really fruitful interaction of the visual slash spatial domain and the musical domain. Okay. So that's my preliminary advertisement for what I'm doing. From my point of view, my work has two parts. I've just finished a big manuscript called The Geometry of Consonants, which is currently at 670 pages, and should come out in the next 6 months to a year. And the manuscript has two parts. In the first part, I try to lay out some very elementary constraints on what makes music sound good. What sorts of properties of the musical stimulus cause us to perceive music as ordered or non-random. And if I had a full hour, I would take you through each of these properties and begin with a completely random sequence of notes, and then by applying them one by one, I would give you a very sort of palpable sense of how each of these properties constrains one another. I'm not going to do that, but it's obviously relevant to the question if you want to take an algorithm and make a musical realization of it, it helps to know how these five properties affect our perception of music. Let me just give you a taste of this by playing you a completely random sequence. You can go to my website. If you type in my name, you'll get to my website. You used to be able to just type in what makes music sound good to Google, but I've become less and less famous, and so my website has been overtaken by someone else. So this is what completely random three-note chords sound like. The only thing I did to that is I added a tiny bit of dynamic variation. Some notes are loud, some notes are soft. It's completely random, but that's just to make it sound a little less motoric. So the two constraints I'll be talking about a little bit more, one is a horizontal constraint, and it says that melodies should move by short distances. So we like melodies like do, re, mi, but we don't really like melodies that leap all over the piano keyboard. And this has to do with physiological features of our auditory system. And when you write music out, you represent it as a two-dimensional graph with pitch on the y-axis and time on the x-axis. And this basically says that instruments should move by small steps as you progress through time. So the first constraint is melodies should move by short distances. The second constraint is that if you look at the simultaneities, if you look at which notes are being played at any one time, say I take a time slice over here at T0, and then I take another time slice at TX, the notes I get at T0 should be structurally similar to the notes at TX. So that's the principle of harmonic consistency. There are other principles such as the notes at T0 should sound intrinsically good, they should be consonant. There's another principle which says if I total up all the notes that have been played over a medium length span of time, say from 10 to 30 seconds, I should get a limited number of notes, 5 to 7 rather than 12. There's another principle which is about certain notes should be emphasized, you should have an uneven distribution of probabilities. Your histogram of which notes are played should be uneven so that there's a sense that one note is a tonal center. I think those are my 5. They're very, very basic, simple constraints on what makes music sound ordered. I'm just going to skip to the end of my demonstration where instead of playing, adding them on little by little, I'm just going to add them all at the same time so you can hear what it sounds like when all 5 of these very simple statistical constraints are satisfied at once. I've also added a tiny little bit of rhythmic variation, so instead of chunk, 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 you hear short duration and a longer duration. But again, this is completely random music, but now its global statistical properties are constrained in the way that I've described. Sounds roughly like what my freshman music students can do after about 6 weeks of training. So 6 weeks of training human beings gets you to just the rudimentary satisfaction of these elementary musical constraints. Now the question came up earlier, why is it that 20th century composers have had a hard time finding audiences? I believe there's actually a very simple, it's a kind of unpleasant, but I believe this is correct, there's a simple answer to this question, which is basically many 20th century composers, or let's say many composers in the extreme avant-garde wing of 20th century music, attempted to replace these 5 very basic constraints with alternative methods of musical organization that simply didn't have the same powerful order-producing effects of the properties that they replaced. So there's two problems. One is they deliberately abandoned these 5 constraints of musical coherence, and another is they attempted to satisfy these constraints with much weaker, with constraints that are much weaker in their psychological effects. And as a result, you can look at music by Schoenberg or Babbitt or Stockhausen, and in terms of its global statistical profile, it's in many ways quite similar to random music. And the fact is people don't like to listen to random music. We're much pickier about what we will listen to than what we will look at. Random paint splashed on a canvas is much less appalling than random notes plunked out on the piano. And there's lots of interesting reasons for this. The arts are differently situated with respect to our internal psychic autonomy. Random combinations of all possible flavors, what I call the aleatoric eatery, this would not be a big hit. Even the most dedicated esthete would not dine at your avant-garde restaurant. So one really interesting moral is that people who are looking to translate, say, the ideas of the visual arts into musical form or into some other sensory modality, they need to think carefully about how the different art forms set different sorts of constraints on what we're willing to tolerate. Avant-garde painting is going to be more popular than avant-garde cinema or avant-garde music. Okay.
Quick.
Yes.
Some of us want to think carefully about this.
Well, I only have a half an hour. I don't have time to think carefully.
You only listen to four.
Okay, all right.
Melodies moved by small distances, harmonies sound similar to each other. Harmonies are intrinsically pleasurable. Total up the notes over 10 to 20 seconds, and you get 5 to 8 notes, and some notes should sound more prominent than the others.
Okay.
That's about it. I named all 5 of those.
Thank you.
Okay. So the lesson of part one is there are these sort of, the question what makes music sound good is not that hard on a kind of very rudimentary level. It has to do with sort of relatively simple statistical constraints on the stimulus. That takes you from zero to mediocre pretty fast. Getting from mediocre to great takes you 20 years of compositional training. Did you have another?
Yeah, very quick. Are those 5 rules statistical rules based on samples of music, say, from Palestrino and across cultures?
Well, I came up with the 5 rules using my brain, which is a kind of crude statistical device.
Yes.
You can look at Western music from before Palestrina, from the 11th century on, and talk about how these 5 principles are satisfied in different ways or not satisfied. You can think of the 5 principles as forming, say, an abstract vector space of possible musical styles, right?
Yeah.
And so the second half of my book does this with Western music. In mind-numbing, brutal detail, I explain how the different styles of Western music, and to some extent non-Western music, are recombining these same sort of fundamental properties.
Thank you.
The question of which of them is, the question of which are innate, which are culturally variable, these are pretty complicated, and to some extent the jury is still out. We don't know the fundamental answers, but some of them certainly are innate, others could go either way. Some of them are sort of deeply rooted in Western culture, but our culture. Okay?
Yeah.
To that point, did you actually give your freshman student a random seed to begin?
Well, we could talk pedagogy. I take my students through the last 1,000 years of music over the course of a year. So we start with medieval counterpoint and progress to impressionism and jazz and contemporary tonality. But
with your example, you said you started with a random seed, and what you got was what you expected the freshmen to come up with. Are they beginning with a random seed?
No, that's what we call inspiration in business, the random seed. They have constraints, and they can satisfy those constraints. They can express their intuition, satisfy the various constraints. Okay, I'm going to move on because we're at 13 minutes now. What I want to do is now move into part 2 of the talk and explain how geometry gets into the picture. Okay? Essentially, a piano keyboard is a line, right? We can move upwards or downwards. Western music, the piano keyboard constrains us to occupy one of 88 positions on this line, but anyone who's ever played the violin or tried to sing knows that we really have a continuous space here, right? The piano is doing us a favor by preventing us from getting between adjacent keys. But of course, there's a lot of room there. So we can model the progression of, we can model keys on the piano keyboard by a line. When you play a series of notes, a sequence of notes, you are of course tracing out a series of directed line segments on the line, and that will become relevant shortly. Now, if you stare at the piano keyboard long enough, you will begin to notice a pattern, correct? Mm-hmm. Yes, there are these 3 black keys, and then 2 black keys, and then 3 black keys, and 2 black keys, and this represents the fundamental psychological phenomenon of octave equivalence, almost certainly universal to human cultures. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, fa, ti takes us back to do, by what I call Maria's theorem from The Sound of Music. And since you guys are all mathematically literate, I don't have to explain why this means we want to take the quotient, we want to wrap the line into a little circle, and just mod out by octave translations, right? And so, in some sense, the fundamental analytical space of music is the circle. Notes live on the circle. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. And as advertised, we come back to where we started. Remember, when you play a sequence of notes on the piano keyboard, you're tracing out a directed line segment in the line that becomes, when you mod out by octave equivalents, that becomes a directed line segment in the circle, which means there's now an infinite number of ways to get between one point and the other. Okay? So what we really want to look at on this circle is not just where you begin and where you end, but we want to represent musical transitions by continuous glides on the circle. And this was not, believe it or not, this was not a fact that music theorists appreciated until very recently. Essentially, what we're seeing here in a very simple form is that the mathematics of quotient spaces are really intrinsically the mathematics of music. Okay, so a chord, on a piano keyboard, there are many different ways to play a chord. I'm going to play C major chords, and you should look at the piano keyboard at the bottom. All of these things sound kind of similar. All these things sound kind of similar. They're functionally equivalent in Western music. They all correspond to different collections of keys played down here, and this is why what standard notation is not analytically very transparent. There are many, many different orientations of your fingers on the keyboard that correspond to the same functional states. On the circle, all C major chords are represented by the same set of points, 0 representing C, 4 representing E, and 7 representing G. So no matter which of these piano configurations I choose, I get the same set of notes there. Let me just explain the numbering. It's very simple. C is 0, C sharp is 1, D is 2, etc. We just number the piano keys. Okay, so what is it to be a C major chord? It is to occupy the points C, E, and G on the circle. In a C major chord, what note comes first? Well, yeah, if you ask an 11-year-old, they'll say C comes first in a C major chord. And then you say, no, look, I didn't mean to compare you to an 11-year-old. What I meant to say is that what's magical, what's remarkable, what's really interesting is that I am going to be talking about musical concepts that you can explain and you do explain to your 11-year-old, and then at minute 23 of the talk, we're going to see how these correspond to geometrical and topological concepts that weren't invented until 1970 or so. 55 if you give Sitake credit. Okay? So the really neat thing is that the 11-year-old's musical concepts define the Fields Medal winner Thurston's geometrical concepts. That's a cool thing. So if you say, look, what note comes first in the C major chord? The 11-year-old says, why? It's C first. And then you say, well, what about this? Well, I can't roll chords here. You play something where E comes first. Is that a C major chord? And the 11-year-old thinks about it and says, oh yeah, that's a C major chord too. It turns out it doesn't matter which notes come first. In other words, chord is a set of unordered points on the circle. Which means if you're thinking about this mathematically, we can kind of think of the basic musical objects, the basic sort of the building blocks of music, you can think of as ordered sequences of piano keys. I actually define a term, a basic musical object, a BMO, is an ordered sequence of piano keys. Obviously, ordered sequences, piano keys can be numbered, so you have a basic musical object living in Rn, and then what we're starting to do is mod out by various equivalence relations. Modding out by the octave takes you to the n-torus, modding out by order, so that you're modeling unordered sets of points on the circle, takes you into much weirder places. Okay, so a C major chord, is this thing 0, 4, and 7? How is it related to a D major chord? What? Yeah, this. Which musicians call transposition, 11-year-olds call rotation, and mathematicians call translation. They're all the same thing. Translation is an isometry of the circle. The ear has developed to care a lot about the distance between notes, but not at all about the position of the notes on the circle. Most of you lack perfect pitch. If I played a C major chord and then told you to run around the building 2 or 3 times and came back in and played a D major chord, you would not notice. It's as if we couldn't tell the difference between red and blue, but we were highly sensitive to the relation between the distance from red to orange and the distance from blue to green. Okay, it's very weird that our brain throws this information away. It's probably selected for. It probably has to do with our need to hear similarities in the contour patterns of male, female, adult, child speech. Right? So it's probably very deep that we throw away this information. Okay, there. So to be a major chord is to be related by rotation to all other major chords. Major chords are sets of unordered points on the circle. The reason rotation slash translation slash transposition is important is because it's an isometry, a distance-preserving relation. There is one other isometry of the circle, which is what?
Reflection.
Reflection, which is transforms the major chord into
minor,
right? So the ear hears similarities between major and minor. Musicians develop these terms, transposition and inversion, that correspond naturally to the mathematical terms translation or reflection. So we also care about the relation between a chord and its reflection. Okay, now, what is it? I said there are these, I started with these basic constraints of musical coherence. One constraint is that, well, if you stop time at any instant, you want to end up with chords that are related by rotation, or nearly so. Let's say nearly so to allow a certain kind of fuzziness. The other constraint is that we don't want the notes to have to move by very great distances on the circle. This means we don't really like this mapping from C major to F major, which involves moving all the way around the circle. We much prefer, if you actually tell pianists to do this, you know, they hate to lift up their hands like this, and they will miss after a certain point, right? There's only so fast that they could do this. What we really like is for each of the notes to move by a small distance, like so. Okay? So what we really have is a kind of math problem. How can we put together these two basic constraints of Western musical structure? We want to find two sets of points on the circle that are related in two ways. They're related by rotation or nearly so. That means they're harmonically similar. And there is a collection of short paths on the circle that take you from one to another. In other words, we don't move by making the rotational relationship transparent. We move in a way that hides the rotational relationship. As essentially, Western composers have been, by trial and error, finding optimal collections of paths between structurally similar chords. It's pretty obvious from the circle representation that the way you can do this is by using chords that divide the octave nearly evenly. That is obvious, right? It will become more obvious. Anyhow, yeah, it's like playing zone defense in sports, right? One thing you can do is, if you're trying to defend in a team sport, you can assign each player an analogous player on the opposite team and say, follow that person around. Short guy follows the short guy, and so on. And that's sort of like what happens when we map two chords in a way that makes the rotational relationship transparent. The other thing you can do is assign each player of your team a region of the playing field and say, whoever comes into your region, you go there. And that's one of the key elements of playing zone defense, is that you have to spread out. It doesn't work to play zone defense if all your players collect in one part of the field, obviously. Anyhow, okay, so now, very briefly, what I want to do is get to the exotic geometry. What we're doing here is a kind of mathematically very unsophisticated thing. We are representing musical objects by collections of multiple points in a one-dimensional space. Any mathematician who had bothered to think about this problem would say, well, why don't we pass to the configuration space? Instead of using two points on the circle to represent two note chords, why don't we come up with a two-dimensional space that represents configurations of these points on a circle? And the configuration space of two points on a circle is a Mobius strip. Here it is. Let me actually make one.
Mobius rather than annular.
Mobius rather than what?
Annular.
Has God made it that way?
There's an explanation, that's fine.
If you look at RN...
There was one, but there is one.
If you look at R2, and then look at how octave translation operates in R2, and how switching the order... Okay, octave translation takes you to T2. Yeah. So now we've got a box with opposite, we've got a square with opposite sides identified. And we mod out by ordering, which means we're modding out by reflections along the diagonal. Okay. And that is Mobius strip.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
It does have its fundamental group is, it's got a circle in it, so its fundamental group is the integers. Okay, so look, over here, 0, 4. Meaning C and E, there's three representations you want to keep in mind. Down here we have C and E, this is what the pianist plays, this is the circle where we've got 2 points in the circle, we're just modding out by octave, and over here we've got the configuration space. So the beautiful thing about this Mobius strip is that it represents both kinds of fundamental musical information, harmonic information. Rotation is reflected by horizontal motion, and we zip off one edge of the screen to reappear on the other. So all chords on the same horizontal line are structurally similar. All the different mappings between one chord and another are represented by different line segments. So I can move from C, E to D, F this way, that's the most efficient way. I can take a less efficient pathway and go that way. I can even do something weird, like this. Oh, sorry, that wasn't weird enough. Wait. That's weird. Where I tell the notes to switch places, watch it on the circle. And now watch it on the configuration space. This collection of 2 points on the circle is now represented in the configuration space by a line segment that appears to bounce off the mirror boundary. And that tells us that this space is singular. The boundary of the space is singular. So this is not a 19th century geometrical space where every point has a locally Euclidean coordinate system. The edges of the space they don't have a good coordinate system, and that's what makes them orbifolds rather than manifolds. Okay, and that's where the fun geometry comes in. Now it turns out that here you can see very clearly the connection between chord structure, evenness, and the possibility of satisfying the short melodies and the consistent harmonies constraint. If you have a chord that divides the octave nearly evenly, it is represented by a line segment that's near the center of the space, which means it appears on two horizontal line segments that are very near each other. The standard routines of Western music take advantage of this fact to take a shortcut between one part of the line segment and the other. So you actually start seeing these sort of patterns exploiting the geometry of the Mobius strip in 1100 AD as monks begin to appreciate the geometry of the Mobius strip as represented in musical terms. Okay, so now it turns out there's a 3D analog to the Mobius strip, which I don't have to tell you is a twisted triangular, the bounded interior of a twisted triangular, two torus. Imagine this lower triangle glued to that upper triangle with a 120 degree rotation. You can build one. It fits in Euclidean 3 space. You have to stretch it a little bit, but you can put one in 3 Euclidean dimensions. The four-dimensional analog, instead of its face being a triangle, it's a tetrahedron. So imagine starting with a tetrahedron, extruding it through the fourth dimension, performing a reflection on it that acts as a cyclical permutation of its vertices, and then gluing together. That's the space of four-note chords. These spaces of the higher dimensional spaces are analogous. This is the space in which triads, major and minor triads, exist, and so on. Now, the really cool thing is that a whole range of musical terms, chord type, tone row, interval, blah, 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 a whole range of musical terms essentially can be translated into different kinds of equivalence relations on RN. So different musical terms define different quotient spaces of Rn. I've been talking about the space that in which each point represents a chord, as a musician ordinarily thinks of it, but you can also create a space in which each point represents a chord type. So now all major chords here are represented by the same point. That space is a cone. Now we've modded out by rotation. So this cone on the right is the configuration space of three points on a circle, modulo reorderings and rotations of the circle. The standard routines of Western music, when you translate them into this form, look like this. They start and end at the same point. They are essentially taking advantage of the geometry of a cone. So now, the thing that I want to emphasize to you guys is that we can build these. We could construct cones such that you touch them and they make music. We can build Mobius strips such that you can play music by interacting with them. I am at minute 31. Okay, so I could go on and on. You can download this program from my website. My book will be out in 6 months. There are two articles in Science that are very incomprehensible, but if you could comprehend them, Science only gives you 2,500 words. If they were comprehensible, they would explain all these different quotient spaces and how they correspond to all sorts of really elementary musical concepts. Obviously this is, I've written a 700 page book explaining the musical relevance of all of this stuff, and that really is only just picking the low hanging fruit. What I want to end with is the thought that composers, in some marvelous way, had an intuitive understanding of these higher dimensional Euclidean spaces. And to show you that, I'm going to play you two pieces by Chopin, the E minor prelude and the F minor mazurka that he wrote at the end of his life. And we're going to watch how these pieces move through the lattice at the center of four-dimensional chord space. Different scales build different lattices in these spaces. These spaces are all continuous. A scale is just a lattice in the continuous space. If you were to look at the lattice formed by the chromatic scale in the center of four-dimensional chord space, you would see a series of four-dimensional hypercubes forming into a necklace linked point to point. So there's another tesseract below this one that shares this vertex, and there's another tesseract below that that shares its bottom vertex, and the bottom vertex of that tesseract shares that vertex with this top tesseract. Since I felt it would be too hard to do a full 3D animation of this, you're going to see Chopin's music move down this lattice, this hypercube, and then reappear on the top and move down again. So this E minor prelude is one of Chopin's greatest hits. It was very mysterious. It confounded analysts for hundreds of years. You can literally read any five explanations of this piece will tell you a different story. When you plot it in this four-dimensional geometrical space, its structure is totally obvious. Chopin is essentially moving down the space one or two notes at a time. What he's doing, he has his hands on the piano keyboard, and he's lowering one note by one step, or possibly two notes by one step each. So it's a kind of free structure, a sort of choose-your-own-adventure, where you can kind of take any number of routes at any one point. However, there's one important element of constraint, which is that when he moves off this vertex to this first layer, he follows a similar algorithm each time. So he first moves to the right, and then he moves to the left, and then he moves to the right, and then he moves to the left. And what that means is that this structure embellishes the descending circle of fifths, probably the most elementary musical pattern that that composers learn. And this structure is hidden because of all the free motions that Chopin takes in this lower part of the hypercube. So believe it or not, hardly anyone recognized the existence of this structure. But when you see it in this space, it's pretty hard to miss. Okay, so now I'll play the E minor prelude, and we will watch it move through a four-dimensional twisted tetrahedral donut. Takes a little bit to get started. out his pattern and returns to conventional compositional techniques. Existed in 19th century music. This combination of constraint, where at some points you are rigidly required to take certain motions, and freedom. This is a kind of musical way of putting together music that we know existed in the 20th century, and we all associate with 20th century music. It's actually quite a revelation to realize it exists in 1828. I'm going to end with the F minor mazurka, which Chopin wrote on his deathbed. It was the last piece he wrote. He virtually rewrote his greatest hit, the E minor prelude. And it's almost as if he felt that first prelude didn't quite say everything he wanted to say. And so what you'll see is exactly the same structure here, only this time when he leaves the top ball, he always moves to the left. Like Dante in the Inferno, always to the left. And as a result, instead of a descending fifth sequence, he gets a descending semitone sequence. So the two pieces are related by what jazz musicians 100 years later would learn to call the tritone substitution. Nobody knew that the tritone substitution was an idea that composers in 1828 were playing with, but you see it's almost built into the geometry of four-note chord space. Always to the right. Oh no, always to the left, yes. Depends which way you're looking. Now we do the whole thing again. Repeat, and he makes different turns. My final thought that I want to leave you with is there is a sense in which Chopin understood this geometry. He understood the different ways of moving from chord to chord. He didn't realize, he had no abstract theoretical language for describing it. He certainly couldn't have translated what he was doing into the configuration space, which turns out to be four-dimensional. But he knew the information that is represented spatially here. He knew it in his fingers. And the fact is, he couldn't fully represent that information by just writing one piece. It's the two pieces together that really show that he had mastered his way around this space. And so that's kind of marvelous that there was this time in human history where we had this tremendous abstract, or some of us had this tremendous abstract knowledge of musical relationships, knowledge that could be translated into rigorous conceptual geometrical terms, but the only way they could express that knowledge was by writing beautiful romantic piano music. The second thought that I want to leave you with is that there's a sense in which not only was Chopin in that position, but his mathematical contemporaries were too. Four-dimensional geometry was in a pretty rudimentary state in 1828, and certainly the idea of configuration spaces and quotient spaces and orbifolds, those were more than 100 years off. So, if you're willing to permit me a tiny bit of exaggeration, you could say that there was a time in human history where the most advanced knowledge of complex four-dimensional quotient spaces was to be found in the fingers of romantic composers like Chopin and Wagner and Brahms. And this is a truly amazing fact. Thank you.
Why is your initial circle a chromatic circle rather than a circle of fifths?
Well, you can't make a circle of fifths continuous. One of the remarkable things is that...
Because in harmonic same tones, you can do it.
Well, okay, imagine a continuous circle of fifths.
Yeah.
Now go 1/7 of the way toward your perfect fifth, and you've got a semitone.
Right.
So you have a circle of semitones there. If you're trying to create a continuous structure, that...
Right, but just take your 12-tone scale and just run around in a star in a circle of fifths, and it's still there.
Okay. Now, so one of the surprising things, almost all music theorists have tried to think in discrete terms, from which point of view it looks like the circle fifths and the chromatic circle are equally good. Mathematically, people often say that the discrete case is the hard one, the continuous case is the easy one, and the discrete case is the hard one. If you think about how the circle of semitones lies in the continuous pitch class circle, which is the log frequency space of piano keyboard modulo octave transfer, one of those circles lies in it in a natural way. The other just doesn't lie in any kind of natural way. Now, you might think, okay, what's the big deal? The big deal has to do with the fact that it turns out you need continuous motions to represent elementary musical objects. I earlier on in the talk, I was emphasizing how when you play one keyboard and then another, you trace out a directed line segment. Now, if you start with the discrete circle of fifths, and then it turns out that these collections of paths on the circle represent ways of getting from one chord to another. So what's interesting about the circle fifth, about this circle representation, is not just that we've got a configuration representing each chord, but we've got a set of paths on the circle representing any possible way of getting from one chord to the other. And what's really new about these spaces that I'm talking about is that they represent not just the instantaneous states of music. People had ways of representing instantaneous ways for hundreds of years, then there's a million different ways of doing it. But representing the transitions from one state to another state in a natural and logical way, that nobody had really had done that. And to do that in a sort of clear way, you want to start with the continuous space. Okay?
Great. Dimitri, early on, you used the phrase the space is more than metaphor. You were talking about dancers, the movement, trespassing. Can you say more what you're implying there when you say
that? Well, right. I think what I was really saying is that translations from one kind of information to musical information are a dime a dozen. You can take sunspots, you can take the fluctuations of the stock market, and you can translate them into musical information in a million ways, and it's not clear that anyone is more principled or less principled than the other. What I was trying to say is that the geometries that I've described here, in some sense, are a fairly automatic consequence of fairly simple musical notions, the kinds of things you teach to your 11-year-old. So what I was trying to emphasize is that this offers a way of translating between the spatial realm and the musical realm in a way that's genuinely enlightening about musical relationships, right? So as a composer, I've learned an awful lot about what is and what isn't possible by re-representing information that I knew partially in my fingers in this kind of intuitive sense, and being able to actually look at the configuration space. When you look at the configuration space of two note chords and you realize how it embodies kind of intuitive knowledge that you've built up over decades of playing the piano, it really is, it's sort of profoundly revelatory. It's as if you were a blind person and you knew how to get around your city. You had specific routes that took you to the donut shop or took you to the ballet studio or whatever. And then suddenly someone takes your blindfold off, gives you vision and a map of your city, and you realize that the donut shop was right near the ballet studio. You just knew different routes for, getting from one to the other. So I should say, of course, there's always going to be an element of metaphor when we translate a spatio-temporal gesture into musical form. But what's neat about this is the thought that there is there's a kind of rigor to this mapping that maybe hasn't always been present when people take DNA sequences and then turn them into music.